Theatrical impresario, leading lady, adventurer and self-starter, Emily Saldine was a relation of today's guest, who is Helen Batten. Helen went to Cambridge, then studied journalism at Cardiff. She had a very successful career at the BBC and is now a therapist. She's author of The Improbable Adventures of Emily Saldine, actress, writer and rebel Victorian, published by...
Alison and Busby.
And this is her second book. Hi. Fourth book? That's fantastic. You've got your therapist, your mother of three, and you've got time to write your fourth book?
Well, I'm an insomniac.
Oh.
So I write them in the early hours. 5:30 and 7:30, yeah.
Fantastic. So where do we start talking about your inspirational ancestor?
I think at the very beginning, because I think her murky start sort of explains why she did what she did, really. Her mother was a bonnet maker who had walked down from the ancestral village in Hertfordshire at the age of 17 to make her fortune in London. And she did very well. She ended up by the age of 30 with her own bonnet making shop just outside the Barbican. So as a single woman and a business owner in the 1830s, quite a feat. Mm. But then she did that sort of time old thing and found herself pregnant. She wasn't married. So she had baby Emily, and Emily was sent back to Priscilla's mother in the Hertfordshire village to be brought up. Emily's grandmother was a landlady. And again, a formidable lady running her own business. Her aunts were also pub landladies. And I think this gave Emily the idea that women could run their own businesses.
So what, does she have any theatrical relations at all? How did she end up on the stage?
No, she had no connections in the theatre at all. Basically, she ran away to get married, as she said, in haste.
How old was she?
Well, she was 20, but in those days you needed your parents' permission to marry before you were 21, which they refused to. Well, her mother refused to, we're not sure who Emily's father was. And she very quickly regretted it. She found herself at the age of 22, two children, very unimpressive husband, living at home with her mum in very crowded lodgings in Clerkenwell. And I think she was very scared of going to the workhouse and what would happen if she kept on having children, if her husband lost his job. There wasn't any safety net. I think the workhouse was very real. So she decided to put herself onto the stage.
So she'd sung around the house sort of thing and in the pub as a youngster, hadn't she?
Yes, apparently she'd always had a good voice and she'd always been bought out at family gatherings. The whole family were singers, sort of lusty party singers. But she said that what drove her onto the stage was pure envy. She read a review of Adelina Patti, who was a world famous singer at the time, a rave review about her debut in London. And Emily was filled with fury and just thought, why not me? The next day, she was standing at a bus stop. She saw a picture of Adelina Patti on a poster, saw that she wasn't very beautiful, that she had a rather long chin. And this made Emily even more furious. And she got on a bus going the other way, straight to the house of a singing teacher and asked to be taught how to sing.
She's incredibly motivated. But as you say, she comes from a long line of matriarchal motivators. So she learned how to sing. Then what was her next move? She tried it in sort of the classical world first, didn't she?
Yes. Mm. Singers, lady performers, they did not have a great reputation.
But because they were meant to be seen as loose women?
Yes. I mean, anyone who, for a Victorian woman, to put yourself in the spotlight, in a public sphere, was seen as not very wholesome. Mm. But the most wholesome, if you were going to do that sort of thing, the best thing to do would be to get on a concert stage. Emily tried this and her reviews were pretty good, but she didn't break through and start getting paid. And she really needed the money. She also auditioned for light opera at the Haymarket. Didn't get in. It was very competitive. So her singing teacher said after 18 months, look, your only chance is to go into music hall.
And that was a step down, wasn't it? Because the music hall... Can you tell us what the equivalent of music hall was in those days, up to now? It was like being on The X Factor as opposed to being at the...
Well, yeah, I suppose it'd be like a soap opera rather than the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
it was the mass... It was a massive, massive theatre for the masses. And it was sort of, if you didn't entertain them, you were off, basically, weren't you?
Yes. I mean, you had to have a very thick skin because they used to throw sort of potatoes at you and things like that. And
So she must have been terrified about this and also thought, what am I doing here? Because she aimed high, didn't she?
Yeah, but she'd also grown up in a pub. So I think she was, she was well able to handle herself. Okay. But yes, there were thousands of people, two to 4,000 people could be in the biggest music halls. They were generally working class, although some very bohemian men about town would go to the ones in the West End. They were full of prostitutes, they were full of smoke, they were full of drinking, they were basically dens of vice.
Sound great.
So she changed her name to Miss Fitzhenry so she could go incognito and not upset her mother too much. And she very quickly became known for her tragic ballads, patriotic ballads. She had a low mezzo-soprano voice and was particularly good at conveying emotion in her singing. So she was known for tragedy, but she became very good at comedy as well. She was very versatile and a good actress.
Because she morphed into being an actress, didn't she? Tell us about opera bouffe. Is that how I pronounce it?
Opera bouffe, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a revolution going on in the Parisian musical scene. Mainly Jacques Offenbach had decided to try a new form of opera that would be more popular, that had tunes. Sometimes they're seen as sort of like ABBA, in the sense of being seeming simplistic, but actually very, very clever. Good melodies, quite risque.
But was it opera or not? I don't really understand, you know, the difference.
Operetta. Light opera.
Yeah, so commercial opera.
Opera. And and these sorts of light operas are seen as the forerunner of West End musicals.
Brilliant.
So... she got a chance to star in an opera bouffe, Offenbach's new opera, The Grand Duchess, when the leading lady of the time had a spat with her leading man, refused to go on. So a carriage was sent round to Emily's house, first thing in the morning, banged on the door, can you come on stage? So within a few hours, no rehearsal, wearing a costume that didn't fit, she was on the stage as the Grand Duchess. Apparently the leading man was whispering horrible things in her ear, trying to put her off. But she said, you may as well have tried to take Nelson off his column. She was deterred. She knew this was her big chance and she nailed it. And from then on, she was hired and she was the leading lady of these light operas that were the rage of the time.
So she became famous and rich?
Yes. The sort of money she was earning, it would have taken the ordinary workman sort of 20, 30 years to earn what she would be earning in a week. I mean, she was able to buy a big house, bring down a whole load of young ladies from the Hertfordshire village to be her servants. Her husband became her manager and sort of retired.
Was that a different husband or is it the same one?
Oh no, she only had one husband.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Once she married, once she never married again.
Okay, so even though he was a failure, she kept him, you know, for respectability probably.
Yeah, and I think he was very compliant. It helped her business-wise to have a husband.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So he was able to basically take up the loans, have a bank account, all those things that you need that legally women couldn't do.
Yeah, yeah, she needed him.
She did need him, and he allowed her great freedom, it seems.
Now, you say in the book that women... Tell us about what the normal middle-class woman, what their lifestyle would be compared to Emily's.
Well, they'd be very much confined to the home or charitable works. It would be that they'd be in charge of the household and running the servants. They'd have a circle of friends who they would visit. They would be visiting each other. But actually, the ability to speak their mind, independently walk down a street, They were very, very confined. So an actress had a sort of freedom, an ability to mix with men and have relationships with men and talk with men and be themselves with men, that ordinary women, well, middle-class women, would not have. Obviously, if you're working class, you're having to go out to work. So you'd be having a sort of freedom in that sense. But
But you didn't have social mobility, which she had. Because she met everybody. Can you tell us some famous people she met and some circles she was in?
Yeah, I mean, she had a special friend called Lord Dunraven.
Do you think she slept with him?
Probably, yes, yeah. I think so. They were very, very close. He used to hang around backstage, take her to his rooms, cook her dinner after the show.
Lovely.
Yes, they used to go on holiday to Margate together. And Lord Dunraven, he was a peer of the realm. He had, he was a journalist. He was in the government. He sailed in the America's Cup. He owned land in Colorado. He was a sort of Renaissance man in the Victorian sense. And they were very, very close friends for a long time.
So that was her love, her aristocratic love, her. Yeah.
We don't know for certain, but I think from what she says.
Because why would someone give you so much attention unless they're getting a little bit of nucky on the side?
That's right. But I mean, she had long lists of people who she outed who used to hang around. I mean, she wasn't a fan of Lord Rothschild. She said that he used to hang around backstage, was very mean with the girls. So he always had lots of sort of jewels on him. And the actresses would expect, if they remarked on it, to be given the odd diamond pin or whatever. And he always said, oh, yes, I would give it to you, but it belongs to a dear friend.
So he was tight.
The Maharaja Singh, who was the last Maharaja of the Sikh Empire.
Fantastic.
Was brought to Britain at the age of 12 and was a great favourite of Queen Victoria. She thought he was rather beautiful. And he loved the actresses, and he always used to give Emily his diamonds to borrow for when she was on stage. Oh. But she made a point of saying she always gave them back afterwards.
Wonderful. So the thing about Emily is that she travelled the globe. Can you tell us about her adventures?
Yes. So once she became a producer, director, impresario, she managed to put together her own production company and tour Britain, and she did very well. Just like today, America was the ultimate destination, and she always had it set her sights on Broadway, and she finally got there in 1874. There was a lot of hype about this new British troupe coming over, and I think she was set to fail, really, and she was very nervous. She realised that the American press was slightly set against her. And when she had the most terrible first night nerves, when she went on stage for the first time, and actually tried to sing and nothing came out. But she gradually got her voice back and ended up in the end being a triumph. And they bought out a Soldine range of clothes. Her face was put on America's favourite sauce bottle. And yeah, she was a hit.
So she became a star there.
Absolutely, yeah.
God, she just... Now, I just need to ask you, how direct is she as a relation? Is she your great aunt, great cousin?
Well, according to ancestry.co.uk, she's my first cousin three times removed, whatever that means.
Okay, so I know what that is, because I'm friends with my cousins who are first cousin once removed.
Mm-hmm.
So she would be, if you met her in normal life, she'd be your cousin. Right, so imagine she's just your cousin, but three times removed means that she's three generations back.
Yes.
So she is your cousin, but she's just... So the removed means that you're just a different decade or different,
yes.
Generation.
Well, I think my great-great-grandfather was her favourite uncle.
Yeah.
Uncle Charles, and she talks about him, and she talks about him singing a lot and drinking a lot. And then when she was a child, she was sort of doing a puppet show and she thought no one was watching. And he was standing there with her mother, secretly watching, and he turned and said, "Good God, Priscilla, you've put this girl on the stage."
Fabulous, fabulous. So it's just so brilliant. How did you find her, Helen?
Well, my nana always used to say we were related to a famous actress. And all she knew was that her name was Lady de Vries. But I remember saying to her, but Nana, was she a real lady? Mm,
dying to know. Am I related to an aristocrat?
And Nana said, no, dear, I don't think so. Not at all. But I knew nothing more about it. And then decades later, I was researching the family history for my last book about my Nana and her sisters. And I was talking to the historian of this village in Hertfordshire, where they're all from. And he said, well, of course, he said, you're related to Emily Saldine. And I said, I've never heard of her. He said, oh, my goodness. Well, you must Google her. So I Googled her. And yeah, she's got this Wikipedia page. Her memoir was available on Amazon.
Still,
yes.
That's incredible.
And there she was, dressed in silk breeches and a floppy hat.
Yes, I want to talk about that. So tell us about the Victorian obsession about women dressed as men. And why did they like it?
Well, I mean, obviously we see women dressed as men as a pantomime thing.
Yes, but they which must have come from there.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But they did it a lot more. These roles were known as breech roles.
Yeah, because they're
wearing
breeches. Yeah.
But Victorian men seemed to have a thing about legs, I think, because they didn't see them
very
much.
Because they were hidden in crinolines, yeah.
And actresses, so the ballet were the only places you could actually see ladies' legs in public.
Also, I think that trousers were shocking because they went up to your crutch, if you think about it. Mm. Just think that they never saw crutches, they never saw up the leg. I mean, seeing an ankle was shocking. So
what it must have done to those Victorian gentlemen's minds, one can only imagine.
But can you, I know, I mean, they must have just, no wonder they're running backstage. Very good career to be in, actually.
But these male roles really suited Emily because the heroine roles were mainly rather weedy and sort of winsome, tiny ladies fainting a lot. They didn't really have much agency in plots. So Emily, I mean, she was very curvy. She had a very commanding presence, this booming mezzo-soprano voice. It really suited her, these hero roles where she could stroll across the stage. I mean, she was very good as Captain Macheath in The Beggar's Opera, Chief Highwayman, she liked that. King Chilperic, she was very good at that, wearing a big crown. She actually had to leap on a live horse on stage.
Fabulous.
While singing the ham song. She was very good at that. So yeah.
A commanding personality,
yes.
You could say. Yes.
So she played a lot of male roles. And then later on, when her half-sister, who's 11 years younger, Emily brought her onto the stage, sometimes they used to play opposite each other. So Emily would be the hero. Clara would be the young heroine. They'd be in a love match, which to Victorian gentlemen would be a signifier for lesbians.
Which again was sexy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they did very well.
Still what men like. And women. Bringing Clara in was a fantastic thing, wasn't it? She did really well because it was like suddenly Clara became a kind of pop star, didn't she?
Yes. Well, Clara was conventionally prettier and obviously 11
more
years...
More petite.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And yes, very sort of, very childlike looking. Mm. And she was 11 years younger. And just as Emily's sort of attractiveness... conventional attractiveness was waning. I mean, in those days, they used to think you were older if you're over 30.
Yeah.
Clara came on stream, so Emily was able to, went into management herself, although she still played the leading roles, and brought Clara on to add the sort of sexual factor. I think Clara was very complicit in this. There was no sign that she minded being a sex symbol, which she was. She was one of the most photographed actresses of the 1870s and 1880s.
So she's a relation as well.
Yes, yes. Well, she's a first cousin three times removed.
Well, you are gorgeous like that.
But there are lots of photos of Clara because a big thing was erotic photography, and actresses were seen as just the most sexy women around. And yeah, and they'd always be doing these poses, which were obviously, you know, holding swords, whips or whatever. And there are a lot of photographs
symbolism.
Of Clara. Yes, yeah. Of Clara like that.
Fantastic. God, well, it's brilliant. They milked it.
Yeah, they did.
It's so clever. But then Clara went and got married, didn't she? Which sort of scuppered things.
Yes, well, everything was going very well until the early 1880s. And poor Emily had a few sort of blows in a row. First of all, her husband had a stroke. and was basically an invalid and had to be retired to Bognor Regis. So Emily started having to manage herself. And at the same time, Gilbert and Sullivan started writing their very British, more conservative, less racy operas, which suddenly took off. And these opera bouffes were out of fashion. Suddenly no one wanted to go and see them. And Emily was very much identified with them. Gilbert and Sullivan would never employ her because she was too racy. So she was out of fashion, without a husband, and I think Clara had reached the age of 30. She'd had loads of proposals, particularly this Lord Linsmore, who was an Anglo-Irish aristocrat, and who Clara turned down many times, much to Emily's total dismay. Fury.
Yeah.
So she turned him down. She turned down other very good offers, apparently, but at the age of 30, she suddenly went and married a 24-year-old gold merchant from Hamburg. So she made a very wealthy match, and Emily was left on her own. And it's from then on that she really started to struggle.
Yeah, the decline started, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because she found when she went on tour, she'd got bad reviews, and then she'd risk all her money. And, you know, I mean, showbiz is just so up and down, isn't it?
Reading the reviews of her in this sort of stage of her life, I mean, it's utterly brutal. We think about social media trolls today, but I mean, the comments that the male reviewers made about Emily's weight, Emily's mouth.
God, so things.
Please take
changed.
Away the corpse. Yeah. They couldn't bear to see a woman over the age of 40 being sexual on stage. It was like, please take away the corpse. The very incarnation of vice, she was called. It was, but she kept on. I mean, amazing. She kept on going on stage, and because basically, well, I was going to say she had no choice. She did have a choice because she could have retired and gone to live with her rich sister Clara, which is what ladies, widows would do in those days. They had rich relations. Her daughter, eldest daughter, married very well. So she could have lived with her. And she could have remarried. She said she had other proposals, but she didn't want to.
Had he died by then, husband?
Yeah. So he died.
So she still had fight in her, didn't she? She still had, she had more to do. And she did have more to do because she went to Australia, and tell us what happened there. How old was she then, by the way, when she was in Australia?
So she first went to Australia in 1878. So she would have been 40. And she was a huge success. They'd never seen such a professional troupe before playing opera bouffe. And they treated her like royalty. So she did very, very well there. And she also went to New Zealand. And again, New Zealand was full of young men. There were hardly any women there. So all these pioneers had come over and they'd forgotten to bring any women with them.
Great.
So the Soldine girls did really, really well there.
Yeah.
But then she goes back as she gets older. And by then, they had their own homegrown opera. Her operas were out of fashion. She couldn't take with her such a good quality cast. And eventually, she went bankrupt in Australia and didn't have the money to get home. She was stranded.
And how old was she then, do you know?
So she was 48 then.
Wow. So, but clever old Emily, she found something else that she could do.
Yeah, well, an old friend of hers, a British journalist called John Plummer, happened to be in Sydney at the time when her last venture folded. And he got her a job as a reviewer for the Sydney Evening News. Now, in those days, being a lady journalist, and that's what they call them, lady journalists, just like her other career, was seen as not very respectable. So women generally went anonymously with journalists. So we don't know how many there were of them, but basically,
like authors, isn't it? You know, they change their name to male names.
Yeah. So for 3 years, she wrote reviews for several Australian papers.
What great fun, though, going to all the shows.
Yes.
You know, showbiz journalist.
But anonymously. So we don't know what she wrote there. But she obviously did well because 3 years later, the Sydney Evening News paid for her passage back to Britain as to be their London correspondent. So
fabulous.
For the next 11 years of her life, she wrote London week by week. prolific.
And she was invited everywhere, wasn't she?
She was. I mean, this gave... I mean, she was very well-connected anyway, and she was always good value at a party. So, but this gave her an extra sort of pass to get into things. So she did go to everything. So all the big theatre events, the big funerals. She loved a funeral. She loved a wedding. She loved a party.
Exhibitions, I suppose. Yeah.
Yes, exhibitions. I mean, she went off to the Olympics in 1908. She thought they were deadly dull. She liked to try out all the technological innovations.
What a laugh.
Yeah. She was really anti the motor car. She thought it was very, very bad attire. Although she could see the point of saving the horses waiting outside the theatre at night and getting cold in the rain.
Oh, it's a lovely way of looking at it.
But the aeroplane, oh my goodness. She watched all the early flights.
Did she like the aeroplane?
She thought that was very, very exciting. So she watched the first postal flight from Hendon to Windsor and land at Windsor. And she loved that. And the tube. She was in two minds about the tube, but she reported on her first journey from Shepherd's Bush to Oxford Circus, and it got stuck apparently. And yes.
So this Emily never stopped. Force of nature.
Absolutely, and right up until the week she died. So her last column was written 4 days before she died.
And was she 58 or 59 then? How old was she?
I think I may have got my dates mixed up a bit because she was 74 when she died. So
that's a very good age in those days.
Well, absolutely.
Because people died at 60, didn't they, really?
Yeah. I think the
life... But her drive.
I think the life expectancy, someone born 1838, a woman born 1838 was 38. So
she
exceeded expectations. Particularly as she was lived life to the full. She smoked, drank.
Yes, I remember her saying that they're calling, she said, they're teetotalers now. She called people teetotalers that didn't drink in between meals. I mean, that had stopped drinking in between meals. She thought that was shocking. So she was obviously always nipping something.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. She liked brandy and soda.
Oh, which is very strong. I mean, what a fantastic woman. And has anything been written apart from a Wikipedia page? You know, I mean, are you the first one to write an extensive biography?
No, so...
I know she wrote her own.
So obviously I was very lucky because I had her memoir and I had a novel that she wrote as well, which is quite interesting.
That's such a good starting place.
Yeah, well, that really helps. And also her voice really comes across in the memoir. She's just got this sort of icy wit. But... when I went to when I was talking to the historian of the family village, he said, the person you need to talk to is Kurt Gansel. So there's a theatre historian in New Zealand called Kurt Gansel, who adores Emily. And he wrote 2,000-page volumes about her with sort of full detailing of all her theatrical doings. And he sent me a copy of these two volumes because I'm family. So Kurt's very helpful.
He was okay about you using it and everything?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I suppose you're promoting her, which is...
Yeah.
But isn't it brilliant that you are bringing her to the public attention? Because, as we know, history is written by men and it's been all about wars. And at last, books about women and social... I mean, to me, I'm not interested in war. I'm interested in what people wore, ate, drank, culture, because, you know, and how they lived. Mm. And Emily lived this incredible 21st century life.
Yeah, I mean, she's quite interesting, though, because she lived as a feminist in a very sort of practical way. She ran her own business, travelled the world, did what she wanted to do, was a working mum. But she was very anti-suffragettes.
I think she's probably, I read that in the book, and I imagine that's because of her age. So it's a bit like us, you know. Any new idea, I mean, I'm older than you, so sort of like I'm slightly like, oh, in my day, or you know what I mean? You slightly become a little bit more judgmental. And she would think that she's done it without that. Why would she? You know, I think it's also that there are these young women doing it she doesn't understand, you know, because she just did it anyway, I imagine.
Well, you're absolutely right that she was a real, true Victorian. And one of the interesting things about all those columns she wrote during the Edwardian period, I mean, it was 11 years through the Edwardian period, was you get a Victorian's view of what's going on, which is sometimes, I mean, she really regretted electrification. She missed dark nights and
the old... Well, I'm with her on that.
And the old sort of traditions and rituals and all those sorts of things.
So people would enjoy reading that who are older, and they're the probably people that read. It's a bit like, you know, this magazine's aimed at older people, you know, which people will read, you know, Saga and things, and it's like Down Memory Lane and things slightly, you know. But also what I found interesting is that you said you had to, when you read her biography, because you'd obviously sweetened it, it's finding, you know, you had to find out the truth underneath her biography.
Oh, well, she very much controlled her brand, as celebrities do today, quite understandably.
So
she makes out that she was from this middle-class upbringing, that she had sort of nurses and all that, and it's just rubbish, you know, she's brought up in a pub. And, yeah, and she, that this Mr. Soldine was her real father. Well, he wasn't. We're not quite sure who her real father was. We think it's this man called Frederick Lambert. Her mother did marry Mr. Soldine, but he was a bigamist. He was married to someone else round the corner and had a fully fledged family and usually was living round the corner because in every census, and he died with his other family. So, yes, and none of that obviously is known. But, I mean, just to go back to the feminist point, when she talked about the suffragettes, she said, let women rule anyway, let them do it with a silken glove. And I mean, the things she really cared about was their social hypocrisy and the condemning of women. This is something that she wrote about, her novel is about, where basically she said something very controversial, which is that women have the same sexual desire as men. And to say that openly, publicly, in 1896, is quite...
To think that no one started really saying that till 1960s. Yeah, so she was way ahead.
Yes. And she said, why, when a man and a woman have an illicit liaison, why is it that the woman who is condemned and the man walks away scot-free?
Still the same.
She said, let him be outed. Let's tell the mother-in-law. Let's tell the men at the club. It should be recognised, and the mistress should be given an official position like they do in Turkey, she said.
Yes.
And the illegitimate children should be helped, not stigmatised, and have the same rights as legitimate children.
So she was terribly radical in her thinking.
Yes, but of course she was illegitimate and had carried that secret all her life, but she never revealed. But then she practiced what she preached, because 2 years later, after she published this novel, she published her memoir, and there she wrote long lists of the great and good, respectable men who were hanging out with actresses.
She was a complete scandal, wasn't it, the book?
Yes.
Yeah, and so it became a bestseller.
Well, she ran off to Australia when it was published.
Good idea.
So when it came out, she wasn't around.
Could be hounded.
And there were threats of lawsuits. Mm. It was serialised in The Express, and...
Which was the biggest kind of popular newspaper then?
There are threats of lawsuits, but they didn't come to anything, I think, because it was all true. Yeah. And so she came back to England, and yes, it was one of the best-selling books of 1898.
This woman is incredible. I think the awful thing was that the children, she didn't have, her children didn't do well, did they? That's probably the tragedy of her life. They didn't have happy lives, did they, her children?
No. She had these four children. We don't know very much about the younger two at all. She doesn't talk about them very much. She was closest to her eldest daughter, Kate, who ran away and married while Emily was in Australia. She was 18. She married a stockbroker's son and did, interestingly, the opposite of her mother, and became a very respectable upper middle class wife and mother. She eventually, they bought Shirley Manor just outside Croydon, beautiful manor house, and brought up her three children there. And Emily would go and stay a lot with her, and they were very close. But tragically, her daughter died of cervical cancer, I think, when she was in her late, mid to late 30s. And this was Emily's big tragedy. And she doesn't write about it a lot, but writes some very poignant things in her columns about, just a grief that will never leave her.
But also remember the other daughter that sort of disappeared.
Yes, so her daughter Nelly looked as if she was going to follow her onto the stage and was doing really well, getting very good parts. And interestingly, she didn't take her mother's surname. She took Clara's surname, so she was Nelly Vasey. I think Emily had become so passé by then that she didn't want to be associated with her mother. It was so sad. But then she ran away. When she was just really getting somewhere in her career, she ran off with a young Scotsman and emigrated to San Francisco. And Emily never mentions her after that.
But you said there's no record of her.
No, well, last seen in San Francisco. We don't know what happened.
God, can you imagine?
And then the youngest son, who she never really talked about, obviously we've got his birth certificate and he did exist, but she only mentions him once. And that's to say that in San Francisco, that she had a son buried in San Francisco. So this is her fourth child who died when he was about 30. We don't know how or why.
It's all pretty tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, she was in Australia at the time at the races, so.
Gosh. But anyway, what a woman. How much did you enjoy writing this book? Because obviously it's your fourth.
It was great fun. Yeah, absolutely. But I was just astonished by what she'd managed to pack in. I mean, she had a long life, but still.
Yeah, but most people just do one of those things. It's a miracle, yeah.
How she managed to do this with such an unpromising start. She didn't have any connections. She had no money. It was just sheer sort of...
will.
Chutzpah, basically.
Mm. Fantastic.
So, I found her very inspirational.
Do you think that she's like you or like anyone in your family? Can you relate to her as a person?
Well, I think it's very tempting, isn't it, to sort of see family resemblances.
But
I don't think we're close enough in terms
you
of...
You are, because you're cousins. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we all sing. Mm. So down the line, that line of the family, they're all very musical.
Is that your mum's side or your dad's?
My mum's side and my nana. And so we all love singing, and that's been a thing. So maybe that's... what we inherit.
And have you looked at the photographs? I think you look maybe more like the
Clara. Interestingly, Clara really looks like my eldest daughter.
Wow.
And I really annoyed her because every time I came across a photo, I'd send it over to her. And she'd say, why do you keep, I don't look anything
she
like her.
She wouldn't see it at all, but you're saying, the nose, the eyes.
No, you really do. But anyway, there we go.
That's fantastic. And so what's your name is Batten.
Mm.
Oh, that's because they all married, because it's the mother's side, isn't it?
Yes,
so yeah, exactly. It's just brilliant. And is your family proud of you about this book? Are they as into it as you are? Have you had a good reception from them?
Well, I think my children get fed up with whatever I'm writing.
What about like family members?
I think I don't know really. I haven't really heard that much from them yet. I don't think they've got copies yet. I don't know. I mean, I did manage to find some descendants, some direct descendants of Emily's in America, because her second son, who we haven't mentioned, who went on the stage, didn't do very well. I don't think he was a very good actor. He's very quite mediocre, unfortunately.
Oh, yes, I remember reading about him. Yeah.
Yes, he settled in the States, and very tragic. He married an actress who was slightly more successful than him, but she died very young, and then he died about 3 years later, and they left these three children to be brought up by charity, really, sort of an actor's... sort of orphan charity.
And how the hell did you find them then?
Ancestry, which is amazing.
What, because of blood samples?
Well, no, because ancestry.co.uk, you can they put you
in contact. I know, but, but isn't it because your DNA matched?
I didn't do it via DNA. So you can do it just via sort of lineage, if you see what I mean, just plotting
a tree.
Yeah,
but how did they know their lineage? I'm interested because you think about brought up like
they've plotted
orphans.
A tree. So one of their, someone down their line has done the ancestry tree.
Yeah.
And so I've been alerted that there's relations. So I've been able to sort of message and contact. So
fantastic. Now they will probably be much more excited being American than the English.
They knew nothing.
Oh.
Nothing about this direct descent. And because it's English, it seems so far away. So I've been in contact and it's like...
Lovely.
It's completely new
to
them.
And where are they in America?
Oh, complete spread around.
Oh, it's brilliant. Gosh, it is such a thrilling book. I enjoyed every moment. It's a rollicking read. So the book is called The Improbable Adventures of Miss Emily Saldine, Actress, Writer and Rebel Victorian by Helen Batten, and it's published by...
Alison and Busby.
It says A and B, so I didn't know what it said for. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Well, thank you for having me.